Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgrades the U.S. long-term outlook to negative this week and warns about the country's rising debt. Here's S&P's David Beers.
If we think that the efforts of Congress and the administration fall short, then the rating could fall.
Libya's rebels fought hard against Gaddafi's siege. The BBC reports that the rebel fighters are holding on in Misrata.
They're very defiant. They say they will fight until they die. They believe that if this town is overrun, many of them will be executed, arrested, sent to prison for years.
Tornadoes touched down in the Midwest and South, flattening factories and homes. Residents of Fayetteville, North Carolina, face the horror.
Disaster. Mess. Just total speechless. Where to go? I mean, who's going to help?
I've never seen anything like that before.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines with Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, Michael Crowley of Time Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation, listeners. Are you polling negative on the president and the economy? Are you worried about the debt ceiling? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from New York City is Diane Brady. She's senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Welcome back to you, Diane.
Nice to be here.
With us from Washington is Michael Crowley, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. Michael, it's always great to have you with us.
Thanks, Jane. Great to be here.
And with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Diane, and Michael.
So let's begin with this New York Times CBS News poll just released, which shows the nation's mood is at its lowest level in 2 years. Here are the numbers. 70% of respondents, 70% say the country is heading in the wrong direction. 57% disapprove of President Obama's handling of the economy. 75% say they disapprove of the way Congress is doing its job. Diane Brady, I'll begin with you. What do you make of the numbers?
I just think there's so much insecurity right now with the economy, with what's happening with inflation, and it certainly doesn't help that there's huge amount of bickering in Washington. So people are looking at either, you know, facing the prospect of higher taxes, fewer benefits. I think there's just a lot of insecurity, and a lot of it, too, comes down to jobs. We're not getting the quality of jobs, and a lot of Americans are still out of work.
Michael Crowley.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the other big factor that I would add to the mix is gas prices. Obviously, unemployment and financial insecurity generally is the most powerful factor affecting a typical household. But something that they can really track day to day is the number of the price per gallon on the big sign over the gas station they may drive by to work every day and fill up at. And gas prices are rising. There are a variety of reasons for that. But I think it really hits people directly and vividly and frequently. I think you see a correlation in polls of presidential approval and views about the economy as related to gas prices.
Jobs, gas prices. Jack, most respondents in this poll think neither President Obama nor congressional Republicans share their priorities for the country.
And I think they're right. I mean, right after the November elections, polls showed overwhelmingly the public's main anxiety, main concern, jobs and the economy. Deficit reduction was way down the list. And what have the parties been talking about for the last 2 months? Deficit reduction. It's no wonder that the economy, that the idea that the economy is getting worse, that 13% more Americans think that now than at the beginning of the month. The dialogue has gone completely from job creation and stimulus to either near-term or long-term deficit reduction. And the public gets, the polls show, that that won't produce a single job in the short term.
Deficit reduction, a lot of debate in Washington this week about the nation's debt ceiling. This as Standard & Poor's downgrades the U.S. long-term outlook to negative and warns about the country's rising debt. Diane, help us understand the significance of that warning this week.
Well, First of all, I think it was heartening probably to S&P that people still pay attention to what the credit rating agencies do. But, you know, it is a very important point, which is the bickering in Washington does have an impact. And people think, well, debt ceiling, do we raise it? Who cares? There's a certain, what the hell attitude that's going on. But the reality is that if they don't work it out, if they don't raise the debt ceiling, that could cause a huge problem. And, there are pension funds, insurance companies that are huge holders of treasuries that would have to dump them because they're prohibited, basically, from owning these if the debt ceiling's not raised. So the impact could be profound. And I think it's just adding to the anxiety level of Americans. And it certainly makes it clear that we have to get this resolved soon in Washington.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner answered that question, will the debt ceiling be raised, on Meet the Press on Sunday. He expressed confidence that the debt ceiling would indeed be raised.
Congress is going to have to raise the debt limit. They understand that. You know, we're going to move forward, and we want Congress to put in place a comprehensive framework, a balanced framework that can reduce our long-term deficits. But if by the time we need to raise the debt limit, we haven't worked all that out, Congress still has to raise the debt limit.
While Secretary Geithner expressed confidence that Congress would raise the debt limit, remarks this week from House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and GOP freshman James Lankford of Oklahoma called the debt ceiling limit into question.
This is not sustainable. We've got to be able to stop this level of spending. If you look at the rapid advance of our spending, you see this generation of leaders that's really been saying, times are tough, and so I'll make it easier on me and my generation by making it tougher on the next generation. You know, those of us that are freshmen are stepping in and saying, that's not right to do the next generation. We got to solve it now.
Diane, the GOP freshman, ran on a platform to cut down on America's debt. And now it seems they're torn between pressure from the administration and pressure from voters. I mean, how do you see
this? There's so much posturing because basically these are lawmakers who created the debt in the first place. And the reality is when you vote for spending hikes, when you vote for tax cuts, you're in essence raising the debt ceiling. So, you know, Obama did it during the time of Bush. This is sort of typical tactics, I think, and we're heading into election season. But the reality is that we have a budget in place. We have certain commitments. They will raise the debt ceiling. The question is how, and how much will they be able to basically get some sort of compromises on the other issues that they'll be running on in 2012.
Michael Crowley, the Treasury Secretary of the Treasury Department, estimates the country will hit the $14.3 trillion debt ceiling between mid-May and the 1st of July. So the clock's ticking. I know you've written about this week. How do you see it?
Well, yeah, the clock is ticking. And, I think this is a kind of a replay of the game of chicken that they played just a couple of weeks ago over a possible shutdown of the federal government. That was kind of a scrimmage for the big game here because the stakes are enormously higher. The stakes were big with the government shutdown, but manageable. You were not looking at a potential catastrophe if the two sides could not reach an agreement over the current year spending levels. This involves the faith of international markets in the U.S. and the possibility of skyrocketing interest rates from some of our lenders. And so as always is the case in these kind of deal-making situations in Washington, I think it will go down to just about the last possible minute. An interesting wrinkle, as you say, is that there's some it's not entirely clear what the drop-dead deadline is. There's some kind of accounting tricks you can do to extend it. The most interesting thing to me here is the way Republicans are playing this because they are torn between sort of an activist base that I think feels strongly that the debt limit should not be raised. They don't really want to hear about about the international financial implications. They just think we need to keep borrowing on the one hand. On the other hand, Wall Street and the business community obviously is an essential part of the Republican coalition. And, for instance, House Speaker John Boehner, it's been reported, has been hearing from Wall Street leaders who are saying, hey, knock it off. Stop playing games with this thing. And it's very interesting to me to see. I think at the end of the day, we will get a deal and Republicans would not actually allow a default. But the degree to which they are willing to make their business supporters sweat and to irritate them over this is a fascinating thing to watch. Mm.
Jack Beatty, how do you see the politics of this?
Well, I'm disappointed, really, in the president for not framing this debate better. I mean, both the Republicans and members of his own party, I think, have really seized the initiative here. This is an issue of holding the country hostage over over some ideological agenda of cutting waste, cutting the government, from a party on the Republican side that just in the Bryan plan voted for deficits for another 10 years, which would be, of course, all disallowed under the kind of limit they want to force on the government. So Obama has effectively been taken hostage by people who are saying, well, we're going to stop everything in order to get what we want for our ideological agenda. And he hasn't sort of come back and said, folks, you can't do this. This is about money, you know, debts we have already incurred, never happened in U.S. history. We can't have this kind of brinkmanship. It's not patriotic. That's all gone. Instead, he's conceded right from the start that there's going to be some kind of coupling of increase in the debt ceiling with some sort of umbrella agreement, tentative agreement about deficit reduction.
Diane Brady, are people saying that the S&P warning is around the entire budget picture, or is it aimed specifically at the debt ceiling?
Well, it does sort of come down to looking at the faith that people have in the U.S. government to basically repay its debts. Now, I mean, it's anchored in this debate right now about the debt ceiling, but the reality is that you know, you need confidence in the markets, and what is a credit rating? It's partly what is the confidence that people have and should have in an entity's ability to pay back its debts. And so if you're basically going out and with the current bickering in Washington, while it's anchored in that, I think it does get to some of the bigger questions that I think are being politicized right now. But what they're saying is people don't have faith in the government necessarily the way they always did. We're not down yet. We just have to watch.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the week in the news. If you're just joining us today, my guests are Michael Crowley from Time Magazine and Diane Brady from Bloomberg Businessweek. Jack Beatty is with us here as well. Let's talk politics for a moment. Into the 2012 presidential campaign, a new Marist McClatchy News poll released this morning shows President Obama would face a statistical tie against former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney if the 2012 election were held today. In a matchup with Romney, Obama 46% to Romney's 45%. Mike Huckabee's up there with 43%. Obviously very, very early, Michael Crowley, but what do you make of these numbers?
Well, it is early, one thing I would say is that President Obama, having had kind of a bump in the polls at the end, you know, around the turn of the year after that budget deal that they did back in December, was doing pretty well, all things considered, given the economy in particular. And there was a sense that, boy, he's going to be really tough to beat. And, you know, going back to the poll that we just discussed and this real sense of pessimism in the country, people feeling the country's on the wrong track, the gas prices, the lingering unemployment, that has started to eat away at the president's approval ratings, and I think Republicans are feeling a little bit of a gust of wind in their sails. And for Romney in particular, I think this is a very useful headline, because what you have now is a Republican field, the whole bunch of candidates, some of whom kind of turn on Republican activists and get the crowds riled up. I'm thinking, for instance, of Michelle Bachmann, possibly Sarah Palin if she intends to run. Of course, Donald Trump, who knows how serious he is. Even maybe Newt Gingrich. I think a lot of people think these are not people who would be able to beat President Obama in a general election. However, Mitt Romney's argument is, hey, you may not love me for certain reasons, in particular the health care law that I stewarded through when I was governor of Massachusetts, but I'm the guy who can win a general election. I have broad appeal, and I think that's a case you're going to hear him increasingly make. The last thing I would say, however, is that New Hampshire is essentially Romney's backyard. He's got a summer home there, I believe, so he's always going to be polling. That's the best place he's ever going to be polling, at least in the early going, so take that grain of salt, although Huckabee's number is interesting to me also because he's obviously a Southerner.
Here's President Obama. He held a town hall meeting at the headquarters of Facebook in Palo Alto, California, on Wednesday. When asked by an audience member if he thought the 2012 budget proposed by the Republicans was courageous, the president had this to say.
Their vision is radical. No, I don't think it's particularly courageous, because the last point I'll make is this. Nothing is easier than solving a problem on the backs of people who are poor or people who are powerless or don't have lobbyists or don't have clout. I don't think that's particularly courageous.
Diane Brady, we've heard the president going after Republicans a lot this week. Of course, this campaign cycle is starting up. We're going to hear more and more, but definite warning signs in this poll for the president.
I think so, and I think it is a big debate as to what is the social contract going to look like. Is it more taxes? Is it means testing for benefits? But I think what's interesting about him going to Facebook as well is this is a president that really alienated Wall Street early on. Wall Street was hugely important in the last election. You know, the fat cats, people are wondering if that will come back to haunt him. It's a very powerful base for him. He raised a lot of money in San Francisco and L.A. We're going to be seeing him spending a lot of time, I think, in the West Coast in the next several months.
Jack Beatty, chime in here. What do you make of the numbers?
Well, first on the venue, privacy advocates have criticized appearing at Facebook because of its, you know, sort of insouciance about privacy. And the Federal Trade Commission, in fact, is investigating some of these questions. And it has all sorts of business with the government. And yet there he is out there making nice with Facebook. I found it very strange judgment indeed. And I think quite right, Diane's right, all about campaign money and also positioning. I'm hip. I'm here with Facebook. But on the campaign, I mean, some very bad news for the Republicans in a Washington Post poll on their issues. They've all voted now, at least in the House, on the Ryan plan. The Ryan plan is overwhelmingly rejected by the public, according to the Post. Nearly 80% don't want cuts in Medicare. 60-some percent don't want cuts in Medicaid. 70% of Tea Party members reject cuts in Medicare, and 72% of the public favor the president's position on taxes, tax the rich. In fact, that seems to be the only way they want to bring down the deficit. Now, those issue positions haven't been translated into political numbers yet. And if the Republican candidate embraces, the Republican presidential candidates embrace the Ryan plan, will the Democrats be able to put those numbers, those negative numbers, onto those candidates? That I think, is an opening for the president.
One more political point, pre-presidential election cycle here. Former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson this week announced that he will seek the 2012 Republican nomination for president. Here he is in Concord, New Hampshire, yesterday.
This is the first time I get to say this, but I am running for president of the United States. And to do that, I think you have to have a certain resume to be able to do that. And I'd like to think that I do have it.
Michael Crowley, Gary Johnson, pretty much an unknown in many key states, but really the only Republican candidate to actually declare a run for presidency so far.
The Republicans are very late out of the gate. There's been I think the field has somewhat been frozen by people waiting to see what some of the kind of heavyweights will do. People were waiting to see whether Palin would run, whether Huckabee would run. Newt Gingrich is untangling his myriad business interests. Mitt Romney is kind of trying to lay low for fear that people will get sick of him. So there are different reasons for all the different candidates to some degree. But quickly on Gary Johnson, he is not well known around the country, but really quite beloved by kind of true libertarians. And I think a lot of them feel that however much they might like Ron Paul, they think maybe he should step out of the way. Paul is quite an old guy. He is not an electric speaker. He does have a quirky charm for a lot of people, no doubt. But I think there are a lot of libertarians who think Gary Johnson's record is as good or better on libertarian issues as Ron Paul, and they like the idea of kind of a vigorous, young, energetic guy carrying that mantle, and they, I think, feel maybe Paul should sit this one out and let Gary Johnson carry their torch.
Jack Beatty, you mentioned the president's trip to California to Facebook this week. I'll follow up a little bit on that point. He made his way to Nevada, to California. And frankly, a lot of pieces talking about how he's devoting his time to gas prices. Michael Crowley, you talked about this earlier at the top of the program, and Americans who could be paying, you know, $5 a gallon here in the not too distant future. It's a big issue that he's paying a lot of attention to.
Absolutely. And I think he recognizes the effect that gas prices are having on his standing. I mentioned how his numbers are down from that peak he was enjoying back around in January. The great frustration for any president, this is kind of a story that comes up with a certain regularity, and every several months or every year or so, there's this outcry, why aren't you doing more about gas prices? And the reality is there's just incredibly little that a president can do in the short term to bring down gas prices, to take decisive action that will show voters that they care, that they are responding. So what you have are these debates about our long-term energy independence, dependence on Middle Eastern oil, drilling. And number one, Washington never quite resolves that problem, and we don't really do the things in the short term that will help us in the long term. And number two, I think a lot of voters just find it annoying and frustrating and abstract. They want more decisive action to chop that price down right away, and it just can't really be done. So it's a harsh position for a president to be in.
And I just want to add that, you know, we're in an environment right now where nuclear energy is really not going to be as popular as it was pre-Fukushima. We've got problems with natural gas. And as Michael said, there's very little a president can do. We're seeing riots right now and demonstrations in China because truck drivers are concerned and, you know, feeling the brunt of gas prices. It's a global issue. And I think the reality is that there's very little he can do except talk about it and basically around the edges try to help Americans out.
Let's bring some listeners into the conversation here. Here's Keith first in Iowa Falls, Iowa. Hi, Keith. Welcome.
I just guess I want to bring forth the idea that at this point in time, we have a big deficit and we have huge debt. But look at our tax situation right now. I think federal taxes as a percent of GDP are the lowest they've been in something like 60 years. And I think we're going on the third year at that level. I think it started in 2009, 2010, 2011 expected to be the same way. But there doesn't seem to be any emphasis on the part of the policymakers to talk about this. And the Republicans seem to have gained the ground saying we spend too much, but in fact, we just don't tax very much in this country. We're down at about 14% of GDP.
Keith, thank you. Jack Beatty, you want to tackle that?
Well, I think he's, you know, on the numbers, I think he's correct. Someone made a very good observation this week. Bill Galston, who worked in the domestic policy shop for President Clinton. And he said what we're really seeing in this budget debate is that the GOP is finally coming to grips with the spending implications of its jihad against taxes. In other words, these drastic cuts in social spending proposed by Paul Ryan, that's really what's implied when you cut taxes. You have to drastically cut social spending. On the other hand, the Democrats are finally going to have to come to grips with the implications of their failure to challenge the GOP on taxes. The Democrats want the spending, but they're unwilling to go to the public and say, folks, you're getting good things for this spending, and let's go back to what taxes were under Bill Clinton. The sky didn't fall. They won't fall on you. And many people think that that probably is what's going to happen. If there's at the 2012 election, should Obama win, that in January the taxes, the Bush tax cuts will expire, and effectively there'll be a standoff. The Republicans will say, we won't go along with raising taxes on the rich to preserve taxes on the middle class. Obama won't accept that. And all taxes will go up. And probably for the economy, that would be the best possible solution.
Diane Brady, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek, give us your perspective on the tax debate.
I think that people are starting to recognize that the tax cuts will have to expire and probably we'll see more because we've also seen the biggest jump in income disparity in a generation. It was tax cuts coming into a major war, and the reality is that right now we do have a very lucrative top end of the country. I think what's happening is there's an eroding middle class, and that's going to be an issue I think that will become more and more clear. There aren't that many people at the top tier, ultimately, that are going to solve our problems. As Jack says, it's going to be a much broader-based increase in taxes, I think, than people are willing to admit.
Here's Gary in Colchester, Connecticut. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, a couple of points. One, if you go way back to Ronald Reagan, which was Republican president, and you say use Ronald Reagan's tax rates, everyone would howl. If you go back to Bill Clinton's rates, which he left his office with a surplus, I think that would be a smart move. And then you look at the president that came after him, President Bush, and we've had 10 years or so of his tax cuts and runaway spending, and people forget that the House, the Senate, and the Congress, all three were controlled by Republicans during that period of time, and now they're all of a sudden say that they have some sanity. And I just don't see how they can continue to hide from the fact they created the debt. Now they want to blame it on the next president and say, hey, we're going to tie your hands and you can't have any revenues to fix the problem.
Gary, thank you. Michael Crowley, would you respond?
Well, I think the caller makes some good points. In particular, I generally have found Republicans don't have a great answer for why the Clinton-era tax rates, going back to the Clinton-era tax rates, would be so problematic given how well the economy did at that time and did put us into surplus. Now, I know there's an argument that in the near term, the economy is trying to get back on its feet. You don't want to have a big tax hike, but you can sort of gradually return to those levels. And I don't think Republicans have a good counter argument for that. I would say that on the question of blame, it's very difficult for President Obama because the deficits that were caused in the Bush era came through various iterations. You had the tax cuts, you had the wars, you had the you had expansions of spending, security spending, defense spending, and the prescription drug entitlement. But really, the thing that I think just is branded into the public consciousness is the stimulus and the bank bailouts. The dollar figures, you know, the very short term, immediate dollar figures for those government actions. And incidentally, the bank bailouts were initiated under President Bush. But there, I think there's a sense that President Obama came into office and just went wild with spending. And a lot of people either think that the spending should not have happened at all, or maybe don't fully appreciate the Keynesian stimulus rationale for getting the economy going again behind that huge $800-something billion stimulus package. So I think in the public mind, Obama came in and went crazy with spending, and that really is the main driver of the deficit. It's not actually the case. So on those two points, the Clinton-era tax rates and where the deficit has come from, I don't think Democrats have done a great job of making their case and putting Republicans on the defensive.
Jack Beatty?
I think that's absolutely right, especially about the stimulus, which, you know, I think even Republican economists concede was a success. It needed to be bigger to be a bigger success. But without it, you know, unemployment would be X and Y higher. But the president had, but they have dropped that. The word stimulus, the Republicans have made the word stimulus, a curse. And so the president doesn't even dare defend what was his own successful program. That is an example of how the Republicans have really controlled the debate. And by the way, the polls show the public has all sorts of criticisms of the GOP, but they say now they are leading the debate in Washington, not the president, the Republicans in Congress.
From taxes to jobs numbers here before our next break quickly, the number of U.S. workers filing new claims for unemployment benefits fell last week, Diane, reversing part of the previous period's increase. How do you read the trend?
It didn't fall as much as some had hoped, and I think clearly we're on the right track, but let's look at the big McDonald's hiring spree, which I think is 50,000 people they're hiring. That's the caliber of jobs we're seeing coming back, and the reality is for many Americans, it's not a working wage. So we're not seeing high-quality jobs, and the reality is there's still a lot of people out there that are unemployed, marginally employed, or have simply dropped out and are not looking.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We've got a great panel today talking about the week in the news. Here are some other news headlines from the week. Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen is in hot water. Did he make the whole story up? Here's 60 Minutes, Steve Croft.
Some of the most touching and harrowing tales in Mortensen's books appear to have been either greatly exaggerated or made up out of whole cloth.
I went into the area to find a place to build a school. What happened is I got kidnapped by the Taliban for 8 days.
A nationwide hiring day at McDonald's drew crowds around this country. John Rodriguez of Denver, an unemployed father of four, is one of many applicants up for an $8 an hour job.
It's kind of hard to make it with a McDonald's salary, but, you know, at the same time, I wasn't making anything. So, you know, I'm not too proud for it.
And Major League Baseball seized control of the Los Angeles Dodgers team, which mired in debt and a custody fight right now. One Dodgers fan was glad to see it.
I think it's just good for the fans and for the city that there's going to be some kind of closure and conclusion to this mess.
My guests today are Michael Crowley of Time Magazine, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's go straight to Libya now, where Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona is meeting with Libyan opposition forces in the city of Benghazi today. He told reporters why he believes their mission is urgent.
I believe that Gaddafi should go, and I believe that a stalemate would lead to serious consequences, including the possibility of the rise of the influence of radical extremists.
And in a news conference last night, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General James Cartwright, discussed the reasons that the United States is sending unmanned drones to Libya.
Their ability to get down lower, therefore to be able to get better visibility on particularly targets now that have started to dig themselves in into defensive positions, they're uniquely suited for urban areas.
Michael Crowley, what about these armed predator drones that the U.S. is using now in Libya? President Obama has given the go-ahead for them. Is this a limited action, or is this some sort of sign that the U.S. is being sucked back into a military campaign that, frankly, the president promised would be handled mostly by NATO?
Yeah. Well, I think it's not clear how much more we'll expand this kind of operation. But in a way, I think it may be I think most likely right now it's probably going to be a symbolic substitute for a re-escalation of our commitment of air power, fixed-wing aircraft flying low, striking targets on the ground with a lot of firepower. I think the drones may be a way to show that we have not stopped paying attention, that although we are expecting European NATO partners to take the lead, that we are still trying to help up to a point. And I think that the president is very wary of getting too deeply embroiled. I think ground troops are nowhere near being on the table, but he is coming under increasing pressure. There is now sort of a drumbeat of politics around this. Conservatives and Republicans are saying that Obama waded into this without a plan. We're now getting into a quagmire. Mitt Romney wrote something for National Review yesterday, I believe, saying that the president's engagement was a muddle, and that we were getting stuck and he didn't have a clear way out. So I think he's feeling some pressure to show, and also I'm sure genuine humanitarian concern, I should say, to do more to help. But I think he is really reluctant to get too much deeper into this. And frankly, you know, as far as the long-term plan, I'm not sure that there is one. I think that their best hope is that continued pressure financially, low-grade support to the rebels will eventually drive Gaddafi out, but it's not clear that it's going to work out that easily.
Diane Brady, how do you see the politics of Libya moving forward?
Well, the reality is that as things go, the rebels are not adequately equipped. There's every chance that Gaddafi would be able to essentially just, you know, certainly not go back to business as usual, but there's no sign that he's really under a great threat right now. So if they want to see him out, something has to be done. But the issue is it's not being done as much under NATO. It's being very much associated with the U.S. And for Americans in particular, that's a huge problem. They don't want to see another Afghanistan. They don't want the U.S. getting involved so deeply in one country.
I'd add this story in Politico this week that Forbes reports that, quote, what looks like an inexpensive military operation in Libya is actually costing taxpayers about $2 billion. Per day. Jack Beatty, this week, France, Italy, and Britain sent advisors to Libya. The U.S. sent John McCain and drones. How involved is the U.S. willing to get here?
Well, you know, in order to meet our objective, the president's espoused objective, Gaddafi has to go, we don't have the means to fulfill that end. That gap has been clear from the beginning. And this week in the Financial Times, a NATO official was quoted saying, I'm in despair over this mismatch. And what he was saying was, look, we have to lower the goals here. Gaddafi may have to survive. The country may have to be partitioned. It is now effectively partitioned. And we may have to make the best of that. But, of course, the president has dug himself in on Gaddafi has got to go. We just haven't committed the resources, nor has NATO, to effectuate that. Although there are signs of sort of creeping mission, you know, of creeping escalation. I read that NATO is talking about sending in guards for humanitarian convoys. That will be soldiers. They're talking about forward ground control observers who need to be protected by soldiers. So it looks like the Europeans are moving closer to boots on the ground, not the Americans.
Two photojournalists were killed in Libya this week covering the violence in Misrata. Here's Musa Ibrahim as a spokesman for the Libyan government. He said that journalists entering war zones take big risks.
We do not kill anyone that does not fight us. We need to check the circumstances in which this journalist died. And it's war, of course. People die from our side, from their side. People get caught in the middle.
Michael Crowley, in addition to the deaths of Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros, some journalists were detained this week in Libya. Is it becoming a more dangerous place for civilians and journalists, generally speaking?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. These are not the first journalists to be detained.
Right.
And I think that, you know, it's a very fluid war zone that is, by the standards of the war zones that journalists have covered in recent years, I think kind of more unstructured, more unpredictable, and more dangerous. It's not like Iraq, which was never safe, or Afghanistan, of course, where you can embed with U.S. forces and ride around in a well-armored Humvee. You have a lot of American, highly equipped American soldiers around you with good intelligence. A lot of these journalists are, you know, essentially riding around in Honda pickup trucks with Libyan rebels who, in an amazing dispatch a day or two ago by C.J. Chivers in the New York Times, some of these Libyan rebels are carrying guns that actually don't fire. They're, you know, parts of larger weapons that are just completely worthless in one man's hands. And these guys are running around sort of pretending that they have weapons when they don't. It's kind of anarchy, and it's extremely dangerous. So you really have to take your hat off to the people who are taking the risks there right now.
Jack Beatty.
And give them credit.
Thanks, Michael.
Yes, and you're getting some candor in that article and in others about the conduct of the rebels. I mean, they have these rockets, and they just apparently fire them without any sense of where they're going. NATO warned a couple of weeks ago that they would use, that NATO would use airstrikes against the rebels if they kill civilians. And it sounds like they're just, by their tactics, they are killing civilians. And that's being reported now in the press, whether that'll hurt the press with the rebels and create problems on that end, I don't know. But it, again, shows the problematic character of this rebellion. I mean, people call it a rabble. It's hard to call people who are so brave a rabble. I mean, they're standing up for an impossible dream, it seems. But certainly at the level of military organization, they haven't a clue.
And Jane, I'll add one last thing about, you know, one of Tim's last tweets was the fact that there were no signs of NATO forces anywhere. So I think it is chaotic. And I also think we should point out that journalists from Al Jazeera, local journalists, are also dying. So it really is not targeting of Westerners so much as it is a very chaotic, unstable situation.
Well, from Libya, let's move for a moment to another story getting a lot of attention, and that is the story of Greg Mortensen, the big story surrounding his best-selling book, Three Cups of Tea, this week. Greg Mortensen, of course, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Did Three Cups of Tea author Mortensen make up that tale that launched him into prominence? Best-selling author John Krakow says yes. Here's more from the 60 Minutes expose. We first hear from reporter Steve Croft.
Did he stumble into this village in a weakened state?
Absolutely not.
So nobody helped him out and nursed him back to health?
Absolutely not. I have spoken to one of his companions, a close friend, who hiked out from K2 with him. This companion said, Greg never heard of Corfe till a year later.
Diane Brady, I mean, the accusations go from lying about a dramatic kidnapping by the Taliban to exaggerating how many schools he's actually built and operated. And most significantly, using his charity, the Central Asia Institute, as his, quote, personal ATM. The Attorney General of Montana, where his charity is based, has opened an inquiry into the allegations. What do you see?
Well, I think it's unfortunate because obviously he has done a lot of good demonstrable work in Afghanistan. You can actually go visit the schools. But, you know, whether or not he used the charity as an ATM, we don't know. What we do know is apparently less than 50% actually went to the schools. But I think it's a sad testament to the fact that there's this compulsion to have more idolatry, more heroics than necessary. He didn't have to basically say he was kidnapped if, in fact, that wasn't the case. But certainly makes for a better story and probably adds to the best-selling nature of a book if it happened.
A lot of calls and comments on our Facebook page, on our website. Here's a call from Liz in New York. Liz, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I watched the 60 Minutes episode. It was crushing and devastating, mostly because I think that most people don't give to causes like that because they don't know where the money's going. And when something like this happens, you know, a golden boy in any field, nonprofit, political, business, generally tend to be turned out to be made of tin. But aside from Greg Mortensen, the nonprofit world is moving toward evaluation and transparency, and that's a good thing, and this shows exactly why. And if people want to know where their gift is going, they should go to organizations like GiveWell.org, and they measure nonprofits based on their impact.
Liz, thank you. Here's Nathan on the same point from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Nathan. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Taking my call. I'm just a little upset because I actually bought the book for my niece. Mm-hmm. I was pretty excited that she was interested in world affairs, and now I don't know how to explain to her on what's true and what's not. I don't know if she might have actually found out watching the world news or the internet herself.
It is upsetting for a lot of people and a lot of money that is in question here. Nathan, glad you called. Let's go from three cups of tea to the Los Angeles Dodgers now. LA Dodgers owner Frank McCourt navigating financial difficulties. Major League Baseball announced its takeover of the team's operations on Wednesday. Dodgers outfielder Matt Kemp told reporters that despite the distraction, his focus remains on baseball.
I'm sure Major League Baseball will do what they have to do to make this team run good, and like I said, all I'm worried about is driving in runs, stealing bases, and all that other good stuff.
Michael Crowley, this is an extraordinary move by Major League Baseball, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think baseball fans are really upset about this. It seems as though the team was being horribly managed. The owner is involved in a divorce case, and I think to some degree we're learning things about the team's finances as a result of that. It sounds like he maybe is misusing money. There are a lot of factors. There's been long-running concern about security at the stadium, and there was a terrible violent incident recently. I think that was a contributing factor, a sense that they couldn't get security together. I talked to a friend of mine this morning who is a sports writer and about this, and he said that the thing that strikes him about the story is that the Dodgers may not be the last team. The New York Mets are in terrible financial trouble, I think in part because the owners had some association with Bernie Madoff, and he thinks there's a real chance that Major League Baseball may have to step in and take control of the Mets sometime in the near future, so may not be the last.
Jack Beatty, what did you make of this story this week?
Well, it sounded like a Hollywood story.
Really did, didn't it? Yeah.
Mega divorce and with the team and the affections of the Dodger fans. It's quite a scandalous story in that respect.
Well, our time is coming to a close here, but I can't leave this week in review without talking about the 1-year anniversary remembrance of the BP oil spill. Here's some sound on that. Here's an oyster fisherman talking with MSNBC about that.
If we can get back to 30% of what we normally did, we'll be, I know it's crazy to say this, somewhat satisfied because at least we'll be able to do something and pay the bills.
Diane Brady, the spill spawned a commission in Washington, but I'm not sure much of its recommendations to Congress have actually been instituted. How do you see it?
No, and I think basically it is sort of poignant on a lot of levels. I mean, we have a company that is, in essence, has roared back in many ways. That's BP. They've filed their anniversary lawsuits against their partners to try and retrieve some of the money. But on the ground, the reality is people not only have not got their livelihoods back, but in some cases, we're hearing about lawsuits that were filed on their behalf, so they don't even have the means to recover the money that's been set aside for them. So difficult situation. Most famous soundbite, I think, of that year was, I want my life back. I think that's true for what's happening with people on the ground. So BP's moved on, but the region has not.
Michael Crowley, I know you've written a lot about this. How do you see this one-year anniversary?
Well, I would agree with that. The one thing I would say is that there is a bright side, which is that it appears, and we have to wait a while longer to get the full toll, but it appears that the environmental toll was not as terrible as it really seemed to be at the height of the spill. I mean, it really looked like it was going to be just horrible devastation. There is no question that it has severely damaged the livelihoods of a lot of people, particularly fishermen. It's taking a long time for some people to get claims from the big compensation fund. However, it does seem that somehow the ecosystem down there was a little more resilient, that the oil dispersed a little more than it might have. And I would just say that the bright side, looking back a year later, is that the environmental devastation, although it will play out over the long term and remains to be seen to some degree, was not as catastrophic as we had feared.
Well, many thanks to my panel for your insights today. Michael Crowley is a senior correspondent and deputy Washington bureau chief for Time Magazine. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Diane Brady, senior editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, always great to have you. Thanks.
Thanks. A pleasure, Jane.
And Jack Beatty for On Point. Have a nice weekend, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. A good weekend to you all. This is On Point.